Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since Friday, Immigration and Custom Enforcement, or ICE agents, rounded up almost 400 undocumented immigrants and some documented immigrants across the country in cities including Atlanta, Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. Days after taking office, Donald Trump signed an executive order stating that almost any undocumented immigrant in the United States could be targeted. The raids have caused fear and confusion in immigrant communities. Fred Morris, a pastor in a United Methodist church in a predominantly Latino community in Los Angeles, recently told the Chicago Tribune, quote, "There is a dreadful sense of fear. It is more than palpable. It is radiating. People are terrified. They were just sitting there in stunned silence," end quote. On today's Your Call, we are kicking off a week-long series on the sweeping new executive orders on immigration that could affect tens of millions of people in the name of security. Today, we are talking about how immigration policies of the past shape immigration policies of today. And we're joined by Kevin Johnson, Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. Professor Johnson's latest book is Immigration Law and the U.S. Border. Mexican border. He also blogs at Immigration Prof and is a regular contributor on immigration on the SCOTUS blog, and he joins us from Davis. Hi, Kevin Johnson. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Lucy Salyer, Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. Lucy specializes in the social and legal history of immigration and citizenship in the United States after the Civil War. She is the author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. And Lucy Salyer joins us from New Hampshire. Hi, Lucy. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
It's great to have both of you. Before we dive in and talk about history, I want to get your take on what happened since Friday. A number of articles are about the crackdowns that happened across the country in many cities, including Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta. As far as we know, up to 400 undocumented immigrants and some documented immigrants were rounded up. There are so many stories of people going into hiding. Parents are now afraid of sending their kids to school. Kevin Johnson, what's your overall reaction to this?
Well, it's a terrifying time for immigrant communities, and President Trump and his first two executive orders on immigration focused on increased enforcement and increased interior enforcement. And I think we're seeing that now in what many people are calling raids in major cities across the country. It fits in, unfortunately, in some ways, into a long history of the use of raids in immigration enforcement, and it's always had very, very terrifying impacts on communities, particularly immigrant communities of color. So it's a frightening time for those who are most directly affected.
Lucy, what would you add?
Oh, well, I would totally agree. I think that whenever you have immigrant communities living in fear, it makes everybody feel less safe. I think in the recent years there's been an attempt to try to create links between law enforcement and immigrant communities to create a bit more trust, and this certainly doesn't help. But it is also unclear how much of a new departure it will be, since deportations have been quite high in recent years, but it's not an encouraging sign.
I read an article in The Guardian that I had to read twice because it's shocking that this is happening in 2017, and it's called Refugees Crossing into Canada from U.S. on Foot Despite Freezing Temperatures. According to this piece, a growing number of asylum seekers are braving freezing cold temperatures to walk into Canada from the United States, driven by fears of what Donald Trump's presidency will mean for refugees. And this piece was written on February 7th. It says, last week, amid the chaos and uncertainty triggered by the travel ban, one agency dedicated to resettling refugees and immigrants opened an unprecedented 10 refugee claims in one day. Eight of the claimants had walked into Canada in order to avoid detection by border officials. Some of these people do not have the proper clothing in this freezing weather. They're walking in the snow. Lucy, when we spoke earlier, you said you also have read this article.
Yes, I did. I find it very disturbing, obviously. I think it's a very sad comment on how the United States is being perceived right now. It's as if it is an unsafe third country, so that it cannot, refugees don't feel able to stay here safely and fleeing to Canada. It's a sad comment on the image of the United States in the world right now.
And Kevin, what would you add?
Well, I think it's also telling that these are asylum seekers, people who under our immigration laws are supposed to be the most favored of all migrants, those fleeing persecution from various sources in their home countries. So we now are in a situation where people who fear being persecuted at their returned home are now going to other countries, Canada in particular, and seeking refuge there. And some would say that's not consistent with our obligations under international law, not faithful to our own domestic laws, and also isn't faithful to our history, or at least our ideals of treating those fleeing persecution with some degree of generosity.
And before, again, we dive into the history, can you both talk about President Obama's record? We did a show a couple of weeks ago about his immigration record. His deportation policies earned him the nickname the Deporter-in-Chief. Under his presidency, more than 2 million undocumented immigrants were deported. The height of the deportations came in 2012. So looking back at President Obama's immigration enforcement policy, what really stands out for you, Lucy, specifically what he left for Donald Trump?
Well, he did inaugurate policies which dramatically increased deportations, over 400,000, I believe, in 2012. I might be wrong on that particular date and number, but I think that, so it is, he has established in some ways the precedent to try to secure the borders. I do think, though, that President Obama's policies were multifold, that securing borders was supposed to come hand-in-hand with significant immigration reform to try to secure a place for children who came as undocumented immigrants, to allow them to stay, trying to prioritize who would be deported, and focusing on people who have committed crimes. So I think that it was never meant to be a sweeping deportation, or not, at least not in the ways that President Trump has now suggested with his new executive order. So I think what's unclear is whether President Trump intends to make this a much more sweeping policy, and I think that's what's concerned, you know, causing the great concern. And I think there's a lot of concern that the next target will be the children of undocumented immigrants whom President Obama was trying to protect and to create a new policy for the future.
According to reports, the applications for the California Dream Act have plummeted by 64% in the 2017-2018 school year. This is a decrease of more than 21,000 applications from the last school year.
That's very dramatic.
Those are huge numbers.
Yes, it is.
Kevin, what would you add when you look back at President Obama's deportation policies? The Nation had a really good article about what he left for Trump. It's called The Deportation Machine Obama Built. And according to this story, to pay for enforcement-first approaches, the budget for immigration enforcement grew 300% from the resources given at the time of its founding under George W. Bush to $18 billion annually. This is more than all other federal law enforcement agencies' budgets combined. And before the end of his first term, the Obama administration had taken a small program developed under George W. Bush that aimed to turn local police into, quote, force multipliers, and expanded it by about 3,600%. So when you look back on what happened under Obama, what really stands out for you?
I feel a little bit ill at ease in responding to this question because I was one of a number of people who served on an immigration policy group for the Senator Obama's 2008 campaign. And I can tell you that he received lots of advice, and he didn't take the bulk of it. from that group at least. I think the Obama administration leaves a very mixed bag when it comes to immigration. I think that Professor Salyer said that the machinery was set up for mass deportations, and President Obama deported more immigrants than any president in U.S. history, 400,000 a year for about 4 years running. And he perfected the Bush program known as Secure Communities that created this deportation pipeline from the criminal justice system to the removal system. It resulted in the end, the deportation of large numbers of people, about 95% of them Latino, even though the immigrant population is much smaller than that. And he went after not just undocumented immigrants, but also lawful permanent residents who had criminal problems. And he also aggressively pursued, all the way to the Supreme Court, some cases involving drugs even a relatively moderate Supreme Court found to go beyond what the immigration statute authorized. At the same time, President Obama more or less stopped focusing on raids in the workplace as the Bush administration had done, and didn't try to engage in these kinds of high-profile raids like President Trump already is doing. President Obama also adopted a deferred action for childhood arrivals program that was designed to provide some temporary and limited relief for undocumented youth who were brought here as young children. And he tried to expand that to allow for deferred action for the parents of lawful immigrants and U.S. citizens. I do think it's a mixed bag. To the extent that President Obama was trying to narrow some of his crime-based removals and trying to focus more on serious criminals, President Trump has already acted to expand the people, the immigrants who are subject to removals, and made it very clear that any violation or any arrest for violation of the criminal laws could end up getting you deported. So I do think this administration, with respect to raids, with respect to enforcement, with respect to probably doing away with the deferred action programs, is much moving in a much more enforcement-oriented area than President Obama, who also was very enforcement-oriented in many important ways.
Kevin Johnson is Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. His latest book is Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. We're also joined by Lucy Salyer, Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. She focuses on the social and legal history of immigration and citizenship in the U.S. after the Civil War. She is the author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants, and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. And today we're kicking off a week-long series on immigration. Today we're going to talk about history and what history can teach us about where we are today. We didn't dive into history right away because there were a lot of raids happening across over the weekend in Atlanta, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York. According to reports, ICE agents rounded up almost 400 undocumented and some documented immigrants. And so we're talking today about what we can expect and what does history teach us? And we'd love to hear from you. How are immigration policies of the past shaping immigration policies of today? If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Personal experiences. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Lucy, the main targets of immigration policies are Mexicans, people from the Middle East, Muslims. You are the author of a book called Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. We've definitely come a very long way from the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, but the similarities are pretty striking. As someone who writes about these issues on a regular basis, what really strikes you about, I mean, what are you thinking about as a historian on these issues?
Well, I'm thinking, as many historians are, that history might not repeat itself, but as the American Historical Association said in a statement it issued condemning President Trump's executive order, they said the past does provide warnings. And so I think we historians are hearing lots of warning bells go off. So It's certainly the Chinese exclusion provides a very dramatic example of how a combination of economics and fear drove policies in the past, and there's a great concern that there's a similar sort of mixture of factors going into this new executive order backed by President Trump. The targets have shifted over the years in terms of which groups have been targeted, whether it be Catholics among Irish and German immigrants in the 1840s or Chinese in the 1880s, Jews and Southern and Eastern Europeans in the 1920s. But what's striking to us is just how much the arguments remain the same and the processes of trying to separate these groups as being somehow un-American and how that creates the foundation for exclusionary policies.
Kevin, when you look at history, what really stands out for you?
I think we see historically sort of ebbs and flows and sort of restrictionist approaches to immigrants and immigration. We see oftentimes in times of social and economic anxiety efforts to keep out the most unpopular immigrants of the day. That has changed, as Professor Salyer says, over time. And today it's the most unpopular are, it would seem, Muslim immigrants and Mexican immigrants. And actually, President Trump began his campaign by spending a great deal of time talking about how Mexico was sending its worst to this country and sort of playing into stereotypes of Mexicans as criminals, and didn't say Mexican immigrants were criminals. He sort of tarred with a broader brush than that. So I do think that the more things change, the more they remain the same in some ways. And it's very unfortunate because we often look at these historical episodes as unfortunate and something to regret, but then we, at the same time, we see them happen throughout our history in times of social stress.
How do you think people should fight back against this dangerous rhetoric that, you know, people are dangerous because of their race? People are called criminals, anchor babies. They don't love their country. What can history teach us about how people should fight back against that dangerous rhetoric? Lucy?
Well, I think education helps, I hope. We are holding a teach-in at our university on Thursday to talk about some of these issues, about the historical examples, to see that this is not the first time we've been in a situation like this. I think also it's been pretty typical that when you talk about individuals and individual stories and the impact that certain kinds of policies have, I think it reveals a very different perspective than when you're talking about people as a, you know, this generic group that stands as this incredible danger. You know, to emphasize that you know, people don't choose to be refugees. You know, people are people are people, mm-hmm. and doing the best they can to provide for their families and their communities. So I think really trying to move away from this sort of sweeping stereotypes is really important. And to also really understand, once you head down this road, the places it can take you are not things we look back with and with, you know, look back on and with pride, mm-hmm. whether it be Japanese American internment or Chinese exclusion, that these stand out for us as not the best times of our history, and not our best. They don't really meet our ideals as a people.
What would you add, Kevin?
I do think that there is room for political action and political engagement and political involvement. I do think, obviously, education is very important, and unfortunately, sometimes people don't really absorb, including President Trump, don't seem to really absorb some of the wealth of social science data that shows, for example, that immigrants are more law-abiding than citizens in many respects, and in fact, immigrants do assimilate into American society, and that immigrants, for the most part, are just like the rest of the people who are residents of our society. But I think now there are activists, there are legislators who are thinking, you know, what can we do as state and local governments to ensure that all members of our community, immigrants, undocumented and legal, feel as if they're full members of the community and are fully able to participate. And I think that I know the California legislature is considering a number of bills that might help in that regard, and I think some local governments are as well. And I think it's important that we do remain active and involved. I think that this issue is one that we're grappling with as a nation. Nobody has all the answers, and I think it's only going to get addressed in an effective and efficient way through dialogue and discussion, as opposed to rash judgments, harsh rhetoric, and mean-spiritedness.
This plan to make California a sanctuary state is getting national attention, and the sanctuary bill, officially known as Senate Bill 54, aims to severely restrict how much local law enforcement can work with ICE, but the bill would not completely eradicate cooperation between local and federal law enforcement, according to USA Today. There's just a lot of articles about what's happening in California. Kevin, you're dean of the School of Law at UC Davis. What do you think about something like this, like a sanctuary state?
Well, anything now has a lot of sort of political baggage attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the bill that's being considered really is very traditional in some ways. Historically, immigration enforcement has been in the hands of the federal government with federal power over who to admit and who to deport, and federal decisions about who to admit and who to deport. And historically, state and local governments have been in charge with enforcing the criminal laws in our cities. And one of the things that you learn if you talk to police chiefs is that many of them don't want to be involved in immigration enforcement or perceived as being involved in immigration enforcement, because if they are, then immigrants and immigrant communities won't cooperate with the local police in ordinary law enforcement activities. So the Los Angeles Police Department has a Special Order 40 that limits the LAPD from inquiring into immigration status of witnesses, crime victims, and those arrested. And the LAPD is not known for being particularly soft on crime or soft on immigration. The reason the Los Angeles Police Department has that is because they want to make sure that all immigrants feel that they can share and assist law enforcement in fighting crime. And if you don't have the help of immigrant communities, particularly in some localities, Los Angeles County, for example, is probably half foreign-born. If you don't have the support of immigrant communities, it's going to be much more difficult to enforce the criminal laws. And I think the legislature is thinking, how do we make sure in this time that immigrants cooperate with the police, work with police, and support the police in their ordinary duties? And the basic idea is by limiting local involvement in immigration enforcement is the best policing strategy.
What else can you tell us about how enforcement rules and laws have changed over time, and why it's important to learn more about this?
Well, I think that many people don't understand that the immigration removal machinery applies to legal residents as well as to undocumented residents. They tend to think of the immigrants community as all monolithic, and that's not the case. Part of the issue in recent years has been that legal immigrants, people with green cards, have been subject to deportation for relatively small crimes like possession of a small amount of marijuana or the possession of drug paraphernalia. And I think that it's important that those people, lawful permanent residents, have ties to the community, they have families, they have employers, they have churches and other institutions they're involved with. And to subject them to removal tears apart families, tears apart communities, and affects the workplace. So it's not just a campaign directed at undocumented immigrants. It's a campaign that's being directed basically to all immigrants.
Kevin Johnson is dean of the School of Law and professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. He's the author of Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. Lucy Salyer is associate professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. And on today's Your Call, we are kicking off a week-long series on immigration. Today, we are focusing on how immigration policies of the past shape immigration policies today. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Become a sustaining member of KALW, a great way to save resources. We'll take an amount that you designate directly from your checking or savings or credit card each month, and we won't mail you any annual appeals for renewing your membership. This saves on paper and postage and makes for a greener planet and a healthier KALW. Learn more by clicking on the support tab at klw.org or by calling our membership department 415-841-4121, extension 1, and thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our week-long series on immigration and the refugee policies by focusing on how communities are responding, how they're dealing with these executive orders, and we'll also hear from people and talk about their personal experiences. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how immigration policies of the past shape immigration policies today. And if you have any questions or comments, if you'd like to talk about your personal experience, if you look at these issues from a historical perspective and you have any short stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Kevin Johnson, Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. Professor Johnson's latest book is Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. He also blogs at Immigration Prof and is a contributor on the SCOTUS blog. Lucy Salyer is Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. She specializes on the social and legal history of immigration and citizenship in the U.S. after the Civil War, and she's the author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. Let's talk about some history. When we look back at the targeting of Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, this also happened under the guise of national security. And we hear the same language echoed in Donald Trump's executive order protecting the nation from foreign terrorists' entry into the United States, the so-called Muslim ban. Can you talk a little bit about this, Lucy, and some of the similarities that you see?
Sure. Well, Chinese were excluded beginning in 1882, although the anti-Chinese movement began at least a decade before that. And what was striking about that is the extent to which Chinese and the U.S. Supreme Court endorsed this view when it upheld the act. The Chinese were depicted as a race that was so fundamentally different from white Americans that it would not only, they would never assimilate into American life, and not only would they not assimilate, but there was a sense that they posed a danger to the nation. And so the Chinese exclusion decision by the U.S. Supreme Court proved to be very significant, partly because it accepted this idea that as a people, the Chinese pose some danger to the very existence of the nation, but also because it upheld Congress's power to absolutely exclude or deport aliens. There's nothing in the Constitution that says explicitly Congress has the right to restrict immigrants or deport them, but the court in this case came up with this broad plenary power that they said was inherent in a nation having sovereignty over its borders, that they can exclude, and later they would argue deport, aliens. So we very much see that kind of foundation going on in President Trump's executive order, this idea that the country can decide to deny anybody admission at any point and deport them as well.
And the Japanese American internment case is a whole different, a similar issue, but different. I don't know if you want me to talk about that now or later.
We can talk about that in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to point to a Washington Post story in 2015 called Donald Trump Meet Wong Kim Ark, the Chinese-American cook who is the father of birthright citizenship. And he was an American citizen. He went to visit his family in China in 1895, and when he came back to San Francisco, he was denied entry, and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Not many people know about him. I didn't know about him, but it's such a good article and such a good story. He was a citizen of the United States, and he eventually went on to win his Supreme Court case. Talk about why this one is so significant.
Well, excuse me, a lot of actually litigation was really important for the Chinese immigrants. When we were talking earlier about what kinds of actions are possible in the face of these types of restrictive laws, the Chinese were very good users, because that's not of the court system. They really perfected the use of litigation. So a lot of the cases that we're talking about now really came about because of the Chinese. So Wong Kim Ark was born in the United States. His parents were Chinese. There was a determined effort to try to deny birthright citizenship to children born of Chinese parents. The 14th Amendment was in existence then, and it says, anybody born in the United States or subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a U.S. citizen. What those the opponents argued, that to be born under the jurisdiction didn't mean just that you were born within the territory of the United States, but that you were born under the cultural jurisdiction. So the argument was that Wong Kim Ark was born of Chinese parents, and he was brought up Chinese, and he would always remain Chinese. It fed back into this repeated argument that no matter what the evidence suggested, that Chinese would never become good Americans, that they could never assimilate. The Supreme Court, it was a close decision, but the Supreme Court upheld the 14th Amendment and said that anyone born in the United States is a citizen. Mm. And it suggested a slippery slope sort of argument that once you deny Chinese, American-born citizenship, then that would be extended to other groups of people. And also to the idea that it was really a fundamental tradition in American law that of birthright citizenship, and it was not a good idea to depart from it. But as we know, it's still an issue today. But
right.
We have this very strong precedent on the part of the Supreme Court, and it would probably require a constitutional amendment to change that.
Well, and you're quoted in this story, Lucy, and as you said, this was a huge case.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
And let's talk also, Kevin, in the story, you know, as the Depression of 1873 took its toll on white working men, they began to look for scapegoats. And so we had mob violence, arson, overt racism in California, powered by the slogan, the Chinese must go. And I mean, these divide and conquer tactics obviously are nothing new. Do you know how the Chinese dealt with these back then?
Well, I know at the time, you're exactly right. And in California was sort of a hotbed for anti-Chinese sentiment, particularly in the Central Valley of the state. And there's a push within the state by a group called the Working Man's Party for the Chinese exclusion laws, and it should have been called the White Working Man's Party. But there is this long history of a concern by workers with the impacts of immigration on their wages and their conditions. And I think we hear some of that today in the kinds of policies that Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump talk about when they talk about immigration, how they're going to protect American workers by keeping out immigrants and deporting immigrants. But I do think that the way, as was described previously, one of the ways challenging these kinds of laws was through litigation. And there was a very organized effort by the Chinese-American community to resist laws like this and protect Chinese immigrants. And sometimes there was some success, as in the citizenship case you mentioned, and sometimes there was some failure, as in the Chinese exclusion case that was mentioned. But I do think litigation, and we're already seeing that with the many pieces of many lawsuits filed challenging President Trump's actions. But I do think that some of the efforts behind these restrictionist laws over time have been designed to allegedly to protect American workers.
Well, we have a caller who has a comment about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Let's hear from Tom in Alameda. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to add to your wonderful presentation a personal story as well as a historical parallel between past and present. My family came from Rangoon, Burma back in 1970 during the heyday in 1969 of race riots and ethnic cleansing of Chinese in the aftermath of the Cultural Revolution. So there was a quote-unquote national security concern on the part of the Burmese government. If you look Chinese, you would automatically suspect a Maoist, even if you knew nothing about it. And also, a lot of the Chinese in Rangoon were not Buddhist, so there was a cultural issue. And that reminds me of the San Francisco situation back in the 1800s, where not only was there a national security pretext, the Chinese were also called heathens. Since they were non-Christians, they looked different, or they wore a pigtail, the ponytail, and their clothing and mannerisms and diets were very different. So that was the reason. And to bring up to the present situation, Donald Trump has brought up clearly national security as a frontal reason to exclude Syrians, Muslims, and Mexicans. And that dovetails with also, I think, tinges of cultural purity issues.
Well, yeah, Tom, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. I think because of what's happening, so many of us are thinking about our own stories and where we come from and our ancestors. I think it would be incredible just to do an entire show and open the lines and get people to share their stories and to really look at what that tells us about where we are today. So I thank you so much for calling in with your story. And if you have a story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. And when you think back about what your ancestors, maybe your grandma, great-grandparents faced, how is that shaping the way you think about what we're dealing with right now? As over the weekend, ICE raids happened all across the country. Almost 400 undocumented immigrants and some documented immigrants were rounded up in places like Atlanta, Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. And then I hope you can read this Guardian story that's really shocking, called Refugees Crossing into Canada from the United States on Foot Despite Freezing Temperatures Because of Uncertainty Surrounding Donald Trump's Policies. It's pushing asylum seekers to take these long walks in the freezing snow. And in fact, two Ghanaian men, they lost fingers to frostbite. I mean, this is happening in February 2017. And we're going to put these, we have these stories at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Kevin Johnson, Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. His latest book is Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. And Lucy Salyer is Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. She's the author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. And today we're kicking off a week-long series looking at immigration. Today we're talking about history. If you have any questions or comments, if you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We talked about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Let's talk about the Japanese, because the roundup of Japanese Americans was one of the worst episodes in U.S. history. The military rounded up every Japanese American and Japanese immigrant on the West Coast, 110,000 people, most American citizens, and they were put into concentration camps. In 1942, Fred Korematsu, a 23-year-old welder born in Oakland to Japanese immigrant parents, refused to comply with the order to get on the bus and go to a camp, and his defiance led to the Supreme Court ruling of 1944 when, in a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court upheld his conviction. Lucy, why don't you take this one first? Talk a little bit about the importance of learning more about what happened to Japanese Americans.
Well, I think there are a couple of points about that. And just to go back about 20 years before the internment, because it's an important precursor to what made internment possible in some ways. In 1924, when the United States passed the Quota Act, which was the most restrictive immigration law that we've had thus far, it did a couple of things. It restricted dramatically Southern and Eastern Europeans, but it also restricted any immigrant who was, quote, ineligible for citizenship. That's meant Japanese, because under the 1790 law, only those who were white could become naturalized citizens. And so we had a racial requirement for citizenship up until 1952. And that's an important factor for all kinds of reasons. One thing I would point out is how often our immigration policies have worked by indirection. You know, there's a lot of discussion today about whether the Executive Act is a Muslim ban, and President Trump and Republicans insist that it's not a Muslim ban. But as historians argue, you have to take context into consideration. And when the 1924 Act said ineligible for citizenship, everybody knew that this act was excluding Japanese immigrants. And that's important for the Japanese and American internment because the parents of children born in the United States, the Japanese parents, could never become by law citizens, even though they might be de facto citizens, having lived here, owned farms and raised children and been active in their communities. They were barred from citizenship. Now, the children, obviously, under the rule of Wong Kim-ark, they were citizens of the United States. And it was General DeWitt who organized and recommended this incarceration of Japanese-American citizens, argued that the racial strains of Japanese remain undiluted, that somehow, even though they were born in the United States, they still were Japanese at heart and in allegiance. And I think there is a similar strain that we're hearing in some of the rhetoric coming out of the current administration. The immigration ban is President Trump's executive order wants to investigate people's attitudes and whether they're hostile to America. And there is this assumption that Muslims are hostile to America. Mm-hmm. So I think this was a very dangerous decision in many respects. The Supreme Court says race is a suspect class, that you should never, that you always are going to be quite cautious using race as a reason to treat people differently, but in this case they upheld it for national security reasons. But it's been a decision that has been condemned since.
Kevin, what would you add, as this is the 75th anniversary of Japanese internment?
Well, I don't have that much to add. I do think it's important to remember that the internment was issued by an executive order of the president, I have to say that there's probably more, even though I think it's flimsy evidence, but there's more of an effort to justify the internment than President Trump put into trying to justify the travel ban or some of the other steps taken. And I do think it's very important for the courts in these kinds of circumstances to take the theory and the practice of judicial review very seriously, because there are checks and balances in our system of government. When it came to the Chinese exclusion case, where the court basically washed its hands, and also in the Korematsu case, where the court upheld what turned out to be a very flimsy evidence based on racial stereotypes, But we should take some solace in the fact, at least to this point, that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit refused and rejected President Trump's claim that there was no room for any judicial review of the travel ban, and in fact subjected it to review and found that, at least for now, it couldn't go into effect.
Kevin Johnson is Dean of the School of Law at UC Davis, and Lucy Salyer is Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. Today we're kicking off a week-long series on immigration, and we're talking about history. How are immigration policies of the past shaping the policies that we have today in 2017? Let's talk a little bit about the wartime Bracero program, which was enacted in 1942 and ended in 1964. And that allowed Mexican agricultural workers to work in the United States in order to make up for the World War II labor shortage. What can you tell us about that, Kevin?
Well, it was one of the early incarnations of what we might call today a guest worker program. These were supposed to be temporary workers who were needed in the fields during World War II when labor was short, and there's a labor shortage. They were sometimes allegedly mistreated by employers. There were supposed to be wage and labor protections. What happened was the employers got the labor, but the workers didn't get much in terms of protections. And I think that the Bracero program, in some ways, reflects sort of the love-hate relationship we have with immigrants. At times, we need and want their labor. At other times, we don't want them around, and we complain about them being un-American and refusing to fit in. And one of the there's a lot of problems with the Bracero program, including the failure to protect wages and conditions for the workers. But it's also just very hard logistically to enforce any kind of, quote, temporary program, because people come to this country and they work and they create those ties with the community that you expect people to create. They fall in love, they get married, they have children, they go to church, they do all those things. And it was, you know, very difficult to enforce the temporary nature of their conditional immigration here. I think that in some ways the Bracero program is a cautionary tale for anybody who's thinking about a guest worker program today, because you want, if you're going to have a guest worker program, and I'm not really taking a position on here, but you have to come up with a system where wage and labor protections are actually enforceable. So that these temporary workers aren't being exploited by employers. And you also have to have some kind of contingency for if they do decide that they, in fact, want to remain permanently here. There has to be some kind of avenue for those people who work, contribute, and become parts of our society to become legally parts of our society. But it's unfortunate in some ways. The Bracero program didn't protect workers, and it also led to a system of labor exploitation and work segregation and actually discrimination against many Mexican immigrants in American society. And it was a big program that lasted for many years, lasted well beyond World War II. As you mentioned, it lasted through the 1960s.
It's such a good point, because as you were speaking, I was thinking about the articles that I read in 2015 about how farm workers in California were landing in the hospital, and some even died because it was so incredibly hot. And they had to fight to get shade, to get water. And it's still a tough fight for farm workers in California and Florida and other parts of the country.
It's hard to get housing. It's hard to get restroom facilities. It was only until last year in California when there was a minimum wage applied.
Right.
So it's the farm work has always been hard work, and actually California was one of the big Bracero states when the Bracero program was alive and kicking.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and we don't have enough time for you both to talk about what you think a humane immigration policy would look like. We're going to do a show about that later this week. But Kevin, where do you see this going? I mean, it's shocking to read these articles. People are taking their kids out of school. They are in hiding. They're frightened about what's to come.
Well, I think it's hard to see where President Trump's going to take this in terms of immigration. I do think we have an immigration clinic at the law school and a center that provides undocumented students on the UC campuses with legal advice. It's important to know your rights and educate yourself about your rights and to be vigilant in these times. I do think that trying to calm the fear that's in immigrant communities is very important now, because you don't want to do anything that jeopardizes your status here, and I think it's important to be careful in all kinds of ways. At the same time, we do have to see how things are going to play out. As I mentioned before, it could be that the Deferred Action Program for Childhood Arrivals ends up getting dismantled, but it's not clear how it's going to be dismantled or what the precise nature of that dismantling might be. So I think it's too early for panic, and I just think that we're going to have to wait and see how some of these things play out, including how some of these things play out in the courts. And I do think it's important that with respect to the Obama administration, I think it will also be true with respect to the Trump administration. The courts have been willing to protect the rights of immigrants in some very important cases.
And, Lucy, we have just about 30 seconds left. What would you add?
I think the courts are really a critical arena, but I would also point to more the global context. Mm-hmm. I think it will be interesting to see the pushback that President Trump's policies might get from other countries and the international law community.
Well, I'm so glad that we have an hour to actually talk about history and learn from both of you about the policies of the past and how it's shaping policies of today. Lucy Salyer is Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire and author of Laws Harsh as Tigers, Chinese Immigrants and the Shaping of Modern Immigration Law. And Kevin Johnson is the Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis. His latest book is Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. Lucy and Kevin, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our week-long series on immigration and refugee policies by talking about the real-life impacts of Donald Trump's sweeping executive orders. We'll also be talking about how communities are responding, and we'll get personal stories. So if you have any, I hope you can join us tomorrow. You can also email in your story. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And thanks to our intern, Stephanie Purcell. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Thanks for joining us.